You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Continue here on a Wednesday hump day, and joining us from Hawaii is Grant Newsham. So, Grant, first of all, appreciate you once again getting up early for us, and we got our shit together today. So, thanks for doing this.
Should have paid more attention to this daylight savings time stuff.
Yeah, you know it happens. But I thought I looked it up online as well. I thought I saw a 2-hour time difference, but maybe I was just being stupid. Anyway, as always, thank you very much for doing that.
Mm-hmm, sure, glad to be.
First of all, Grant, you made your living in the Marine Corps as an intel officer?
Yes, that was it for a number of years.
Okay.
And I guess when you're an intel officer, I don't know how much you actually know. But the name sounds like you do know something.
It sounds, yeah, pretty ominous. I'm curious, what do you make of all the leaking from very high places that you see in Washington, D.C. these days?
I just think it's ridiculous. I think horrifying is probably the right word. Embarrassing would fit as well. You hardly know what to say. One does know, it just gets the impression that a lot of the leaking seems to be everywhere, but there seems to be some intelligence-related leaking, there's obviously likely suspects, but it's embarrassing to see this happen. I think if people are that serious, then what you do is you give your name to a reporter, not this anonymous stuff that's going on, and you make your case. But this is it's embarrassing to see what's going on here.
Yeah, I think American politics are in a sorry state. I think that the system that gives you Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump to choose from is a fairly broken system, and I think. What we see in terms of the conduct of the people that are quote unquote nominally leading the federal government, intelligence agencies, and these leaks are not coming from, you know, low level, you know, Bradley Manning types. Okay, in order for you to have access to either the transcript of what went on between the president and the ambassador to Russia. You have to be a pretty high person in an agency to have that, and then to take it to the media and to violate your oath it's pathetic. And now it is the way that Washington operates, but I just for the life of me, I shake my head and look at it and say, at some point, don't we do something about all this leaking of extremely high-level information that goes in our government by people who are dissatisfied? If you're dissatisfied, honor your oath, resign, and then go public with what you think, I think, without, you know, including classified information. But to me, I agree with you. It's disgusting. It's disheartening. And I think, worst of all, it's dishonorable. So what do you think happens in all this, Grant? How does it go when you have this kind of conduct going on?
You know, I really don't know. You know, I would say a couple months ago, I thought it'll eventually play out and things will calm down. And you know, the administration can get on with the business of just governing. But this does seem to be an unhinged reaction to the election, which is not something one expects from the United States. But I don't know, I honestly don't know how this is going to play out. And as you mentioned about the leaking, and there was an article yesterday in I think in the Post, Washington Post, quoting a number of current and former intelligence sources. To somebody who has some experience in the intelligence business, the idea of leaking is just anathema. And I would suggest it indicates they've hired too many of the wrong people into these jobs. And I would also suggest people who have not done their jobs properly. And I would cite a couple examples. One is the admission by the former deputy director of the CIA that the organization missed the rise of ISIS or ISIL in the Middle East. I mean, they missed it, for goodness sakes. Nobody seems to care. So he makes this comment, and he's still considered a reputable commentator on these things. And the second point I would make is regarding the Russian influence allegedly in the Trump campaign and the apparent need for an investigation to figure out what happened. Now, what I don't understand is that the CIA, and principally, and as an intelligence service, should already know what the Russians have done. They should have the Russians penetrated, and they should know what Putin does, what he thinks, if they have done their job. But it doesn't, and so the question shouldn't even be a question anymore, because it should be completely answerable. It doesn't seem to be, and yet the press, and I would cite the Washington Post, having delivered the thing as a child and lugged around 40 pounds on a Sunday morning, they should be doing a much better job. And this is a different species of journalism, where you consider anonymous sources and really obvious partisanship to be the way that things should work. And I would just say it's embarrassing in a number of respects, and I'm hoping that the people behind it grow up. Or I think as Robert E. Lee said at some point about the Yankees, can't these people just leave us alone and let the country get on with moving along? So there.
It doesn't seem like that's anywhere close to being on the agenda, though, Grant. And you know, so I wanted to ask you because your thoughts as an intel person. You know, one of the things it's almost like the metamorphosis the SEALs have made. The SEALs used to be right, swift, silent, and deadly. That was their motto. You didn't hear from them. And people said, well, what are these? And so our curiosity, I think, as a nation, stemmed from the fact that we didn't see them in the media. Now there is no more public military organization than the SEALs. And they, I think, have a crisis in their community of, you know, you join the Navy, not to join the Navy, you join the Navy to be a SEAL. And you breed these glamour pusses. And it's not like the Rangers where you join the Army, right? You get to the infantry or wherever you go. You test in to go to Ranger school. You go to Ranger school. You then apply to go to the regiment, but you're a soldier first. When you're a SEAL, you go to BUDS training, a lot of times straight out of boot camp. And so is the intelligence community suffering from a little bit of the same? Is that a fear that all of a sudden we don't like Donald Trump? We don't like the way he handles his business. He certainly isn't a career politician. And so we're going to make it known by leaking and betraying our oath. Because I sense in your voice this morning disgust. And I think you've stated as much. But that used to not be the way of the intelligence community.
Oh, you said it. You started with the SEAL example. If you remember 30 years ago, maybe 35, that people barely even knew they existed. These days they have TV shows, and one might still consider British SAS and Special Boat Service as by and large organizations that know how to keep their mouths shut and still do very good work. It seems as though on the U.S. side, Delta Force knows how to, as they keep quiet and go about doing good work. I don't know what the problem is, but I do see that, my guess is that the problem largely is at higher levels in the organizations. And surprisingly, I say very high levels, where you simply have a sort of charlatan who has risen up the up through the organization, being accomplished yes men, people who make their careers in Washington, claiming to know how the system works in D.C. and how to work inside the Beltway. And a lot of these people have very, my understanding and my guess is that they have very little actual overseas field experience actually doing the hard work. And that's why you can have organizations that simply have not accomplished what they're supposed to do. And, you know, I cited the rise of ISIS, couldn't find WMD in Iraq, and Bin Laden for 10 years, and yet nobody seems to care that their primary mission has not been accomplished and is not being done. But I would say my guess is it's really at very high levels. It's not at what you would call the working level. And I think that most people do understand this commitment they made not to talk about secrets. It's just amazing. And people might say, well, that's how Washington works. Well, it shouldn't be that way. And it would be nice to see the press actually do their job and ask if these organizations are in fact doing their job, or if their greatest success is trying to subvert an administration, and that goes for any administration. That would be a more interesting question, I think, to ask. But we're just not getting that from the press, by and large.
No, well, again, I think we're expecting something from them that they can't give us. I think they are click-driven businesses. They need to drive people to their websites. And in order to do that, it needs to be overheated. And it is that way. And if you're looking for measured, responsible discussion, where do you go to find that? And it's a very, very short list. And again, in my mind's eye, I lament the loss of the McNeil Lear NewsHour, where you had bright, experienced people tackling difficult questions and having articulate discourse. Where do you find that these days? Where do you find restrained, articulate discourse done in a responsible way? And the answer is, it's a very, very short list.
Yeah, it is a short list. There are some good areas. I would say Christian Science Monitor has historically been very, very good. Wall Street Journal often does good work, Financial Times. But really, sometimes, I don't wish to be cruel, but because having grown up with these papers, but you sometimes get the impression that with New York Times and the Washington Post these days, it's a choice between Pravda and Izvestia back in the old Soviet Union.
No, they certainly seem to have an agenda. And, the story, went around yesterday about the newsroom of the Washington Post cheering when they posted the story about the leaking, quote-unquote, classified information. And to that end, if the president chooses, while he's trying to make a point, to include intelligence that he knows to be valid on a key point with the Russians, that's his decision. He can do that. Now other people can certainly, if they choose to, say, well, that wasn't prudent and it should have been this or that. He's the president of the United States. And if he chooses to include that in his discussion, and think about it. Do you think that past presidents have not done that?
I'm with you.
It's stupid. Yeah. I mean, it's stupid. So when you look at the headline and you listen to the overheated discussion, it's like, you don't know anything about our history. You don't know, and so it just, you watch it and just go, oh my God, where are the adults? When are they going to come home from a night of drinking? Please come home and help us.
Yeah, well, this is one where you do see this as an unhinged reaction to Mr. Trump. And really, if one reads the commentary about what has allegedly been revealed to the Russians, and if you can somehow figure out what probably happened, what the details are, it really is concocting something out of nothing. And it you know, it's, again, it's embarrassing, and it's really third-world performance by, unfortunately, senior intelligence officials and ultimately the press. So it's it really is disappointing. You know, when I was thinking about this just yesterday, in fact, that when you think about what presidents do, and I don't remember, one does not recall similar sort of brow, sort of breast-beating and hair-pulling when Mr. Obama was overheard on an open mic talking to, I think it was the Russian foreign minister, saying something to the effect, well, tell Vladimir Putin, that once the election's over, I'll have more room to maneuver. And this is Putin, who's murdered his opponents, probably blew up a apartment building in 1999-2000 or so with Russians in it so he could start a war with the Chechens. But currently we have a president who is on a first-name basis with Mr. Putin, and nobody seems to care. So, you know, obviously one remembers a little history, not all that long ago, but it does seem, it is, this whole thing today is troubling, and it's kind of funny that it's almost more uplifting to contemplate prospects of war in Asia than it is what's going on in Washington.
You know what? I would tell you that that's in fact the case. Let's, you know, because I can hear myself saying in my mind. All right, on a lighter note, let's discuss Korea. It's not nearly as troubling. So anyway, any other thoughts that that you would have about the leaking, about the intel piece of it? Because I think as a professional, it's incredibly disturbing to think that somebody, and I'll tell you what, let me get your thoughts on this. H.R. McMaster was in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you told him, if you put a gun to his head and told him to tell a lie and said, you've got to walk out there and say this, what would he do? He'd tell you to pull the trigger, right?
He would. To think otherwise is just amazing. And this is McMaster who was in the room. And the commentators, you know, you get a sense really of just how corrupt, ultimately, these people who are advocating and pushing and bullying to harm the administration, just how really insane they've become. And I would say the same thing if this had been done about any previous administration. And it's, when you've got McMaster in the room, that does tend to, it should give the charlatan some pause, but you'll notice that it doesn't.
No.
Not ideal.
No. So you watch that and it's just, I don't know. Okay. So, let me take a quick break, Grant. And then when we come back, we'll, onto a lighter subject, Korea and successful intercontinental ballistic missile launches, so we'll lighten it up. Anyway, Grant Newsham, my guest here on a Wednesday. We've been talking Washington, D.C., the media, and Grant, a professional intelligence officer. So, or formerly a professional intelligence officer. Now he's just another human being like the rest of us. So we will take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life. The Bolasoft Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Globalsoft website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Globalsoft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines. All you Mustangs, listen up. The Marine Corps Mustang Association is comprised of Marine Corps officers and officers from other military services who share a common background. They're a group of men and women who initially enlisted and served with distinction in the Marine Corps and the Marine Corps Reserve enlisted ranks. The term Mustang refers to a commissioned or warrant officer who has risen from the enlisted rank. In their 33rd year of existence, the association continues to dedicate itself to the advocacy of professional development and encouragement of younger Marines, demonstrating a pathway for advancement and offering mentoring, advice, and camaraderie over the course of their military service and civilian careers. The Marine Corps Mustang Association is looking for a few good Mustangs to join their association. Contact them via their website at MarineCorpsMustang.org, or you can find them on Facebook. Go ahead and like them there. Most importantly, join their association and help them continue the great work that they do. That's the Marine Corps Mustang Association. Join it today.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue on a Wednesday. Grant Newsham joining us from Hawaii.
Hawaii.
You with me, Grant?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. So, first of all, you're in Hawaii today, yes?
Yes, that's right.
You're a bit of a world traveler. Do you have a favorite part of the world that you visit?
I like Singapore, with Southeast Asia. It appeals to me. It seems exotic to, at least to American art, to me. Croatia, I'd recommend that, the Croatian coast. But I've only been there once, so I don't have much to compare it to.
Okay.
But I like that. But Southeast Asia is always good.
Singapore is a bit intimidating with the caning and all. I remember getting a brief and said, don't chew gum or don't spit gum out on the ground. You'll be arrested immediately, which gave me cause for pause. But it's a very clean place. And I enjoyed it. I came to respect the Brits. I came to respect the Brits because they taught everybody how to speak English, and so whenever you visit places, you can kind of get around and navigate a bit because the Brits have made it easy by teaching people in far away and exotic places how to speak the English language. So I have great respect for them.
Well, that helps, and I think even in Tokyo, if you're a Westerner, if you go to a subway, if you stare up at the subway map long enough, somebody will come up and try to help you in English. So you can go anywhere.
All right, let me read you an email, and You can comment on it if you care to, and then we'll move on to Korea. This madness is not about clicks. It's about the establishment media versus Trump, and Trump's not smart enough to resist the bait. Bezos owns the Washington Post, and Trump has run his mouth about that. Don't discount that angle. What do you think? Are we settling personal grudges?
I think that it sounds right to me. I think there's a couple things that the sender, I think, is correct about. One is the new ownership of the Post. This is a partisan operation. And that doesn't take much to demonstrate. But the second is that, yes, Mr. Trump, sometimes you do have to keep your mouth shut. But if you're always counterpunching, it'll never stop, and you won't be able to do the things that are most important. So I do see this as a key part of the issue. One anecdote which has stuck with me was from the campaign when there was a Washington Post reporter, actually a well-known one, who was revealed as basically being on the Democrat side. And that's not what reporters are supposed to do. I'm surprised that he can even show his face in town, but he's still around. And I think it does typify, unfortunately, what has become of too much of that newspaper. And it is an important newspaper.
I think you could write that story about most newspapers in the nation. That, again, I have a business in my head, and that is, it's called the Credible News Network, CNN. but what it would do is I would take disabled veterans, and it would be a bit like the Drudge Report. But what we would seek is credible writers who not only are reporters by name, by title, but they also are reporters by deed and the way they live their life, the way they write. And I think that there would be a huge hit. And so I'm hoping as we get going here on Almer and Radio to establish that. And I don't know what we'd call it, but it would be, these people genuinely report. We know this because we know their body of work, and when you come to this page, that's what you'll find here, is credible reporters reporting in a technical sense of the journalistic term. That's what you'll find here. So, but it's becoming more and more rare, and you can say it's not about clicks, but I'll tell you what, if it was about honest journalism, that guy would have been fired.
Oh, he just fired himself. I just don't know how these people can still stick around. There was the one well-known leaked email of, I think, John Podesta, where it was a political reporter who said, well, I've become a hack now. And yet, that was grounds for moving to a desert island and just staying away from people. Yet he's still in the business, and so nobody seems to care. But there is, I think, a demand for good reporting, and there is plenty of it if you look for it. And it does stand out. But maybe that's the thing, is it stands out, whereas it used to be what reporting was.
All right, let's talk about the Western Pacific. The significance of the missile launch by the Koreans, most recently was what? Let me just do a little background. We talked about, I asked Grant, I don't know, maybe it was a month ago, these launches that fail almost immediately. Do we have any way of knowing, is that us, is that them? And Grant's response was essentially, we have no way of knowing, but normally missile programs are plagued with these kind of problems, and at some point the Koreans will work it out, and they will have a successful launch. So congratulations on that prediction. What is the significance of their successful launch?
I think this one demonstrated some improvement in their capability, and there's just these things. Over time, they get better and better in terms of range, distance, accuracy, and they're figuring out problems step by step. And this is, as I've mentioned before, is really just an engineering problem or an engineering question at this point. And eventually, the North Koreans will, on this trajectory, will be able to send missiles where they want them to go, and hit what they want them to hit, and have nuclear weapons on them if things continue in this as they are. Also, it does demonstrate that the North Korean regime, Mr. Kim, he really doesn't, is not currently not impressed by anything that's been done or been said regarding his behavior. And it's, some people also note that now there's probably something to it that this latest test was also a message for China, that Kim is not as intimidated by China as one might imagine. Which is sort of counterintuitive, but there's a certain logic to it.
All right. So I will follow up. I'm going to sound like an attorney here. I will follow up with another question that we've asked you before. One of the things that we discussed was China has not helped for 25 years. Yet all spotlights have skewed to China and their role in helping the world and the United States deal with North Korea. Are the Chinese doing anything? Are they doing anything? Or are we urinating into the wind still in that hope?
I think probably the latter. I think that at some point, and I would suggest a quarter of a century is probably long enough to get a sense of whether or not somebody is going to do what you want them to do. And so you're finally starting to see some decent reporting on some of the assistance which China and Chinese businesses, all done with the knowledge of the Chinese government, have given to North Korea and still are. Also looks at the growth in trade between China and North Korea just in the last year. And it's been substantial. It's been enough, certainly, to keep North Korea afloat and in a, more than just afloat. But there's an ironic part of this debate, and that is that the U.S. administrations, even this one, has said that because we need China's assistance with North Korea, we cannot be firm or strict with China on other things because they're going to help us with North Korea. However, China themselves, if you read what they say, they're constantly claiming they have very limited influence with North Korea, and in fact claiming they have none at all, and therefore it's the Americans who are to blame because the Americans will not talk directly with North Korea. So here you have the U.S. side saying we've got to get this Chinese help with North Korea, so we have to overlook a lot of misdeeds that China does. And then China is saying, but we don't have any influence over North Korea, although everybody knows they could turn it off, turn North Korea off in a week if they wanted to. So we're the ones who are allowing ourselves to be fooled.
To what end?
Really, it's the way one chases a mirage, thinking that if we can just get them to help us, we can solve the problem. And if get China to help us, then we can solve North Korea. But China doesn't want to, and they've even said they know they can, but they say they can't. But we say chase this mirage. While we do this, you find that North Korean missile development, nuclear development, it continues on a steady upslope, a gradual upslope, and that is, you can see where this is going to end up. Whilst we're chasing the mirage, we're going to eventually end up with an enemy, sort of a declared enemy that it has the ability to hit us and hurt us, plus to blackmail and intimidate regional nations and South Korea, Japan, and beyond, and it just has a way of sometimes leading to arms races, sort of increased, worsened military first starts with friction, and then at some point something often happens. And so whilst we chase the mirage, there's a lot of bad things which are developing, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out where this might end. Figuring out exactly how it plays out is always hard, but figuring out where North Korea gets, if not checked, but that's easy to figure out.
Well, let's walk the dog. So how does North Korea get checked? The United Nations was going to hold, I believe, some kind of hearing or a meeting on the subject of North Korean nuclear weapons development. So where does it all go, Grant? And then I've got an email for you. So where does this all go? Does this all end with the United States that stands here as the North Koreans continue to develop nuclear weapons? And now if they can put a tip on technology, they just proved it can be successful at least once, then they can range the United States. And then we negotiate with them in a very, very different manner, much as an equal. And so you have this almost, I would say it almost is this farcical nation, that all of a sudden becomes legitimate because we've not done anything to, you know what it reminds me? It reminds me of the movie The Mouse That Roared. With Peter Sellers in it, and I'm not a Peter Sellers fan, but it's of this little nation that wants to get rebuilt because it's in terrible condition. So they decide they're going to invade the United States, and then because they know that the United States will rebuild them after they start the war, and then they'll surrender. The United States will rebuild it, but nobody So anyway, that's what the movie's about. But it's this crazy fantasy. This reminds me of very much the same thing. You have this crazy dictatorship in an impoverished nation that's going to be allowed to develop a nuclear weapon because there's nobody there to stop it. And then we'll deal with it as a nuclear nation. It sounds crazy to me. So does anything stop this short of American military intervention?
Oh, hard to say exactly what will happen, given our ability to chase this mirage willingly, and that's successive regimes. So it could end up that way, but we do have, there are cards to play, and as I said, there is, despite the UN sanctions, US sanctions against North Korea, these have never been enforced anywhere near as they could be, and I think this still remains a very powerful card. Which is the really very strict financial and economic sanctions against North Korea, but you would also at the same time have to apply them to China as well. So that because of China's assistance to North Korea and to its nuclear and missile program, and without that pressure on China, so that China can do the cost-benefit analysis and see there's more to be gained from doing business with the United States than there is from doing business with North Korea. There has to be almost that stark a choice, I think, to really get some Chinese assistance here. So that is a card which could be played. I would suggest it's better than actually fighting a war over this thing. It's almost anything is better than that. So we have the tools. I'm just not sure that we're going to use them.
That tool would be what, Grant, specifically? What tool do we have that we haven't used?
I would say we have never cracked down on Chinese companies, and most of these with some government connection if you track it back far enough, Chinese companies that have continued to provide assistance to North Korea.
Okay.
Additionally, if you look beyond China, in a number of other nations, there are companies and entities which have been assisting North Korea. They're not hard to figure out. Go after these, and you have got to really savage these entities and even the nations themselves if that's what they're going to support. Also, you de-link North Korea from the U.S. dollar economy, and you de-link anyone who assists North Korea from the U.S. dollar economy. And at that point, once again, it gets very difficult if you can't operate in U.S. dollars. And that is just an immensely powerful tool. It was used successfully during against a bank in Macau in the mid-2000s called Banco Delta Asia. And it really had a huge effect on the North Koreans and the Chinese. And yet after about a year and a half, the Bush administration canceled the sanctions, all in arrange for an agreement to talk by the North Koreans. So that's one, is one tool, one bit of pressure that you could use. As for the United Nations, I don't see them as being of any assistance at all. You've got really a Chinese and Russian veto and support for North Korea that have really prevented it from doing much against North Korea, but also within the organization itself. I think it's repeatedly proven itself incapable of handling a serious international problem. And once again, that goes, it just has not been successful, really, ever, one might say. So I'm not confident about North Korea. There's other things we could do, which is really start to build up our alliances in Asia better than we have, and that would be useful if we could pull that off. And even consider things like bringing nuclear weapons back onto the peninsula, the Korean Peninsula. But you've really got to show some nerve and apply some pressure to have any hope of success. And whether or not we'll do that, I have no idea. But we do have some cards to play if we would play them. But ultimately, as you've noted, the Kim regime is ultimately, that is going to have to be dealt with, and it's just a horrific regime from any sort of human rights standpoint. And until the world actually addresses that issue as well, this is going to be a tough problem to solve, and we just might end up someday, not in the too distant future, with a North Korea, so with those missiles, nuclear armed, that can hit what they want them to hit. And then it'll be a very different sort of dynamic and almost a different sort of world that we're dealing with.
The latest discussions I've heard about the United States and China economically have been about using credit cards, being able to use credit cards in China, and it's for closer economic ties to the Chinese. The discussion seems to be economically going in the other way. Are we attempting to curry favor with the Chinese by doing things favorable? You and I have talked about if the Chinese were to help, what price would they exact? So is it just business as usual, and we're not really dealing with Korea yet, hoping the Chinese will? What do you make? And the president said he describes everything like this. He had a great meeting with the Chinese down in Florida. And so what do you make of all that? Post that meeting, and again, the long specter of Korea, was cast over that meeting to see what the Chinese would in fact do. Based on, nothing's changed since the meeting though, correct or incorrect?
No, nothing's changed. It does seem as though this administration has sort of backed off on some of their initial statements about getting tougher, more strict with China. Following that meeting in Florida, which is not what I would have recommended. But it does, the whole thing seems to typify the absence of a broad, comprehensive strategy towards the North Korean problem. That includes military, economic, political, diplomatic, and the various sort of pressures, the various sort of avenues on which to apply pressure. And it doesn't seem to be a consistent strategy yet. And this recent economic agreement, which you just mentioned, that was, I think, brought about by Wilbur Ross, I think, it's almost as if it's been done in isolation. And it's really just, these are agreements on the margins to somehow deepen U.S. and Chinese economic ties in some very specific areas. Right. And you find some of them, it's just China agreeing to do things that they should be doing anyway. And I don't consider it a great achievement at all. I don't think it suggests any sort of improvement in the fundamental relationship between us and China, nor any sign that China is going to help with North Korea. So it just seems to be done in isolation, and I wouldn't take it too seriously, although it is presented as a great success. But really, it's China stringing us along economically.
Okay. All right. So no change. Everything else continues, and we go sideways with other than, you know, the announcement that the that a carrier battle group was headed towards the Korean Peninsula, that and some other things on the margin militarily. Nothing essentially changes in the Pacific.
I don't see it. It just seems to be sliding in the sort of a towards something not very good, but maybe it's just sliding slowly. But that would be my take.
Okay. All right. Can I take another break, and then we do about
sure.
Come back and do about 15 more minutes? I have an email here that's kind of interesting that talks about conflict on the peninsula, how it would happen, and so I want to ask you about that. So Grant Newsham, our guest here on a Wednesday on All Marine Radio, we're talking about events in the Western Pacific, and it's a much lighter fare than what's going on in Washington D.C. So we will continue. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
All you Mustangs, listen up. The Marine Corps Mustang Association is comprised of Marine Corps officers and officers from other military services who share a common background. They are a group of men and women who initially enlisted and served with distinction in the Marine Corps and the Marine Corps Reserve Enlisted rank. The term Mustang refers to a commissioned or warrant officer who has risen from the enlisted ranks. The Marine Corps Mustang Association was founded by Captain Robert Richter, United States Marine Corps retired, in Philadelphia on 10 November 1985 as a nonprofit veteran service organization. In their 33rd year of existence, the association continues to dedicate itself to the advocacy of professional development and the encouragement of younger Marines, demonstrating a pathway for advancement and offering mentoring, advice, and camaraderie over the course of their military service and civilian careers. The Marine Corps Mustang Association is looking for a few good Mustangs to join their association. Contact them via their website, MarineCorpsMustang.org. I say again, MarineCorpsMustang.org. Find them on Facebook. Go ahead and like them. Most importantly, join their association so that they can continue to do the great work that they've done for the past 33 years.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. I'm still laughing about the discussion of the Korean Peninsula being lighter fare than what's going on in D.C. Somebody sent me an email. Hey, Mac, it's extremely sad, but what Grant said made me laugh. It is less painful to talk about Korea than our own national government. How funny. So congratulations, Grant. You've become somewhat of a comedian now.
Stand-up comedian.
let me read you an email. Mac, I am interested in how Grant believes if a conflict were to break out on the Korean Peninsula, how would that happen? Would it happen quickly? Would there be a slow buildup as American forces arrived on the peninsula? Or would the North Koreans strike before that? What are his thoughts relative to a conflict on the peninsula? So, Grant, let's just say for the sake of argument that this that a conflict was going to happen. How do you see that happening? Do you see? I mean, what we've seen in the Middle East in the past is there's this slow buildup of American forces that's allowed by whoever our adversary is. Rhetoric gets more and more heated. The UN, there's some kind of UN event, whether it be the Americans going to present a case to the UN or whatnot. Talk to me about the war on the Korean Peninsula. We've been war gaming it for years. How do you, as somebody who's familiar with the region, how do you see, if it did happen, how do you see it happening?
Well, if I can also tell you the score of next year's Super Bowl with the Redskins winning by 9, but they, I think one way I look at it is that North Korea is going to continue with its nuclear and missile program. This is their fundamental. This is their priority, because once you have that, you're safe. Nobody can really do much to you at any reasonable cost in most cases. So that's going to continue. So you're going to see, I think, continued North Korean missile tests, even nuclear tests. The world, or U.S. at least, is going to complain a lot, the Japanese and the South Koreans. But North Korea has always done whatever it feels like doing. And it's going to continue to do this because this is its fundamental national interest. This is their their fail-safe, their get-out-of-jail-free card, if they have those weapons. And you're going to see, I think, a really increased pressure and worry concern by the U.S. The Japanese will be playing into this somewhat, but they have just supporting role. It'll be the U.S. That's the main player. North Korea as well, I think, will be unable to avoid having to face up to the fact that North Korea is an enemy. And then at some point, it wouldn't surprise me if a U.S. administration really in alliance or in consultation, particularly with the Japanese and the Koreans and even some of the Europeans, might say that we have no choice but to put a stop to the nuclear and the missile threat in North Korea and then fire away at that point. I wouldn't anticipate sort of a long build-up, say, along the lines of what's been done in the Middle East. But I think the pressure will gradually build based on North Korean behavior. And eventually, and the U.S. will do everything it possibly can to think of a reason not to do anything. And at some point, I think that there'll be a spark that pushes ultimately a U.S.-led operation into starting. But one thing worth keeping in mind is that it's often overlooked or discounted is that the North Korean regime does, I believe, see as its long-term objective to control or to seize the entire Korean Peninsula or South Korea. That is often dismissed because the idea is, well, the North doesn't have the capability and it would be suicidal for them to do it, but I don't think that's an accurate assessment. I think that the North does see its ultimate objective as a unified Korean Peninsula under North Korean control, and it believes that that is particularly doable if the U.S. commitment to South Korea can be eliminated or reduced to a really low point. So that North Korean desire to get the entire peninsula, which is, it helps to understand some of North Korean's thinking, and it's a useful thing to consider when thinking about future events on the peninsula.
I certainly find that delusional that they believe that, you know, that they would be able to achieve that. And so, so let's walk down the kinetic piece. So things escalate, first of all, rhetorically between nations, and then high-level consultations between the United States, Japan, and South Korea. Japan, South Korea, and the United States all begin to ready military units. And at some point, there's a spark, whether it be two aircraft shoot at each other, something gets blown up. Again, everything I've ever seen from the Koreans, there is not, and you said, this is not going to be a short exchange of missiles and this thing stops. This thing has been brewing for 70 years, practically, and when it gets going, how does it stop?
Well, I think it'll stop either with the North Korean regime out of business, or, and this assumes the U.S. somehow decides it isn't worth getting involved on the peninsula, or it could end with a real bloodbath in South Korea. And who would come out on top, I'm not sure. I suspect the South Koreans would have the ultimate advantage, but it'd be a Pyrrhic victory. But I wouldn't, going back to this idea that it is suicidal for the North to attack the South in a serious way. It was also, it could be, it probably is, but at the same time, it was, one might suggest, suicidal for Japan to take on the United States in 1941. Sometimes, from a regime's perspective, what looks suicidal to us looks like a reasonable way of the dice.
Well, wow. Okay, so to the next question, once this thing gets going, how does it stop? I mean, the North Koreans have been readying this for 70 years. And if they, and let's just say it doesn't shake out. They're unable to strip away the United States and Japan from South Korea. But now this thing goes. once it begins to go, how do you put, and there's an exchange of missiles, civilian populace targeted, special forces units across the border, I would think. How does this thing stay contained, or does it, if it goes?
Well, I would suspect it could probably could stay reasonably contained on the peninsula, although, you know, there will probably be some missiles and special forces operations, for example, against Japan. And obviously China is going to be pretty interested about what's going on. There's a possibility at some point of Chinese involvement. But I would suggest mostly at this point, it would be just a very nasty fight on the peninsula in difficult geography. And you might compare it not in any, just loosely to something like the Iran-Iraq war, where it was a pretty rough fight, but it was reasonably contained. But a problem with a war on the North Korea peninsula is that this involves first world countries, this will involve first world economies, and the ripple effect on the global economy of a war on the peninsula will be, I think, widespread and pretty serious. So it would be, there's no sort of punchline to all of it. This would be a pretty rough business and pretty unpleasant. But it does, so hopefully it doesn't come to that. But if it does, it will not be a short, easy thing. But it will be a bloodbath, and it will have to, I think it will have to be pursued to the finish.
And if it, in your opinion, the North Koreans would be foolish if they were unable, well, let me ask this, do they strike first? If after some spark, do the North Koreans say, okay, it's time?
No, always possible. And, you know, a lot of things depend on how a few other things play out over time. And once again, it's that U.S. commitment that really is a stabilizing factor. And if somehow, say, for example, you get a new Korean regime, which, or new administration, which is, you know, does think that North Korea is actually a potential friend, and gets too close and too friendly with North Korea, and one could imagine at some point a U.S. administration saying, well, if South Korea wants to be friends with North Korea, that's fine, but we're not going to die on behalf of South Korea, particularly since North Korea claims that they're going to shoot nuclear weapons at us, and that U.S. commitment recedes or weakens. And at that point, the dynamic changes, and the North Koreans may think they have an advantage at that point, so to try and predict the future often depends on how certain things play out, but you can at least see that, I think, as a possibility, or the U.S. commitment could stay as strong as it's ever been. And that would probably, that would be a good thing, in my opinion, and would probably do something to restrain the outbreak of war, although at some point the North Korean nuclear missile development effort is going to force a U.S. administration to decide if it wants to live with that kind of threat and blackmail, or if it's going to bite the bullet and go take care of it.
The email, Mac, could you ask Grant to comment on the most recent election in South Korea and his beliefs as to the implications for the North versus South relationship. So they just had a big election there, and I don't know how you would call them. I would the Democrats won, in I don't know what the actual party name is in South Korea, but the more liberal party won. They want to have a dialogue with North Korea, from what I've read. Your thoughts on that election and the implications for this conflict in not only rhetoric, but in nuclear weapons?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think everybody's asking it. Yes, the new administration with President Moon is it's to the left of the previous administrations, of course, but it does reflect a sort of a part of the Korean sort of society that does And so there's a generational aspect and also a regional aspect to it. But it tends to take a less, what's it called, negative view of North Korea than say the conservative faction in Korean society. And there is this idea that, you know, they can build relationships, work things out, and gradually reduce tensions, and then somehow, in some unexplained way, come together as Koreans. And they use it's a theory. One might ask what's the, and it's kind of been tried with what was referred to as the Sunshine Policy back in the 2000s. Towards North Korea, and I would say the results don't appear to have yielded as sort of a nicer North Korea. But once again, some time has passed and these kinds of beliefs are pretty strongly held, so the new administration does seem inclined to restart the Sunshine Policy. But that said, I think I'm reasonably optimistic that the new president, that he will understand and value the U.S. presence, the U.S. relationship, and there's some indication of that. But there is definitely, it's always worth remembering that within South Korea, there are people who are very conservative against North Korea, and then others who are sort of like on the U.S. side, there's almost a give peace a chance crowd that we have plenty of as well. It's not that dynamic at play. I think that Kim in North Korea is not going to modify his behavior. They are going to do everything they can, once again, to push for these weapons, nuclear weapons, missiles, and test these things. And I have a feeling that it may wake up the new Korean administration, and they'll pull back a bit from some of the things that they were saying they were going to do. So Kim has a tendency to make people more conservative by his behavior. But it remains to be seen exactly how that plays out. But I'm somewhat optimistic, and I think the U.S. side of the administration does have some pretty good people handling Korean affairs. So we'll see how it goes, and it would be nice if we would actually make something of the fact that this is you have a Korean administration that has just removed a president by the legal process, had an election, demonstrated consensual government, and there's no one wonders why China could do the same. So in some respects, North Korea has been a good example of how countries can run themselves. But really, it's up to the new administration in Korea to weigh the risks, and hopefully they will look at what happened in the Sunshine Era and realize they didn't get much out of that.
All right. Another email question. Matt, can I pile on with another South Korea question? If the United States and Japan were stripped away from South Korea and it was just the North and the South, would Grant assign a percentage to who might win? Is it 50-50? Is it 60-40? In which case, which direction? If he were a betting man, what would he say? So I know you're not a betting man, so I will take that off the table. But how do they stack up if South Korea fights by itself?
I think South Korea would probably win. Costly, probably in the millions, perhaps, in terms of lives lost. But I think South Korea ultimately would win. They would get pushed back a bit. And why I say this is that because if it looked as if South Korea was going to lose, America would get involved, I'm pretty sure. Unless the estrangement between us and South Korea was just unimaginably bad. But I think we would come back in and really defend a democracy, a consensual government, and one that was our ally for many, many years. So that's what I think is the determining factor, is that if it looked as though the South was in real trouble, I think America would come in. And at that point, I think it would be able to really choke off North Korea's ability to continue the fight. But I do think if somehow the North could strip away the U.S. and Japan from South Korea, the U.S., really the U.S., from South Korea, that I think the North just might have a go at it. And they would certainly increase the blackmail and the intimidation to very, very high levels.
Wow. Wow. It's just incredibly sobering to even continue it. I sit here, though, and, you know, so I guess the last question I'll ask you there this morning, Grant, and we certainly appreciate your time and, as always, making us smart about these kind of things. With no additional pressure exerted on China, we continue to wait for them to do the right thing, and it seems like they're content. So all this talk about real Chinese sanctions, have you seen anything that that has impressed you relative to new Chinese sanctions and them and China being serious, or is it simply more rhetoric?
It's the latter. You know, if someone said to me, "Okay, Lucian, here's a check. Write it out for any amount you want, say $2 million, but you have to construct an argument that China has actually helped apply sanctions in a serious way against North Korea," I couldn't do it. They really have been of no help at all, and it's just one excuse after another. And but to their credit, they recognize that we fall for it. So we'll see how this administration does.
All right. What would you, again, I keep asking you to look into your crystal ball, and I'll do it again. What will we see next?
I think it's going to... The tension is going to get worse and worse. I think, as I say, this North Korea is going to continue with their tests, missiles and nuclear. And that is the key, because having those weapons allows you to really hurt somebody, hurt us. And they've never had that before. So that's going to continue, and it's a problem which the U.S. administration cannot keep avoiding, and at some point it's going to have to make a very tough decision. It could be this administration or another one, but I think this is not headed in the right direction, and we're coming to the point where we won't be able to kick this can down the road for another 25 years. So we'll see how this happens, and there's obviously other things that, you know, the whole U.S.-Korea relationship. We'll see how that plays out with the new administration in Korea, but I'm fairly confident. I think the relationship will survive. But the North Korea with weapons of mass destruction, we could ignore the idea for a good long while, but I don't think we can anymore.
A final question for me. Do you think ultimately that the United States will do nothing? The Chinese won't help. Ultimately, we will be doing nothing, and we will... because North Korea needs nuclear weapons in order to assure their existence. And for whatever reason, or at least that's their rhetoric, you know, we as a nation don't have the resolve to confront them. And they will obtain nuclear weapons. At that point, the game changes, and we say, okay, now we will sit down and negotiate with them. Ultimately, do you believe that that's what's going to happen?
Well, I think if I were inclined to bet, I would probably put a small wager on that. That often seems to be how we do things. You could look at the Iran nuclear deal and, you know, squandered every chance to avoid this, to avoid Iran with these kinds of weapons. So it is, seems to be how, I'd say, democracies and consensual governments like ours is often how we do things. We take the path of least resistance and try to avoid fighting, avoid tough stuff. Just, and maybe that's human nature, but I think that there's a good chance that maybe what we end up doing is, you know, you can always sort of rationalize the danger, rationalize the pain, and sort of in the way you avoid going to the dentist to have your wisdom teeth removed. So we have a good history of doing that, and I think somebody might have asked that same question in about 1934, and said, "You mean we're really going to do nothing about this thing?" And then 5-6 years later, well, they really did do nothing about Hitler. So it remains to be seen how think that is not an unreasonable possibility.
Wow. Well, it's certainly a encouraging morning. I just don't see us as having the resolve. And I've got one more email for you, which is kind of interesting, which is another kind of look into your crystal ball. And that's this. Mac, I'm curious. Does Grant see at any point in time China having a civil war? Because the forces of freedom, when they're unleashed in a population, are extremely powerful. China has a revolution coming, and I think we all know that. And it's a revolution spawned by freedom of information, freedom to live the way you want, and ultimately economic freedom. If and when that happens, China will move into the realm of the United States and away from Russia and North Korea. I think that will be a good thing. God only knows it will when it will happen. I would think, though, certainly within the next 50 years, China will have a second revolution, and it will become some type of socialist democracy. I'm curious about Grant's thoughts about that. Does he see anything like that in China's future? Yeah, you thought you were asked the crystal ball question before. Tackle that one, big shooter.
Well, this one, you know, it's not far-fetched. You know, it may take a while. I think it's actually a possibility. And why I say that is that there's, although, and why it would take a little while is because the Communist Party, the Chinese regime has a very impressive internal security, operation. The fact the internal security defense budget or budget is bigger than the defense budget. So there is a sort of fragility to situation inside China, and despite the image that's presented, but there's a lot of fractures and fissures in the society, a lot of resentments, particularly over things like corruption. And it was corruption that brought down the old KMT before the communists took over. And the Chinese leaders know this, that it was corruption that just caused such immense discontent that it brought down the regime. And they try as Xi would like to do something about it, at least to stop his enemies from being corrupt. Personally, he doesn't mind himself. But but they understand the risk. And they understand just how delicate all this is, and that's why they have such a strong, such a repressive system that cracks down on any dissent. That said, within China, you've got, you know, there is a lot of unhappiness. You've got basically about 100 million people who've done very well, and about 900 million that are dirt poor. And this is resentment. The grounds for resentment had already existed. And so you also have regional problems within Japan. So the northerners and the southerners don't like each other very much at all. There's huge resentments there. You have a regime, a ruling class, which is doing everything it can to get its money out of the country into somewhere safe. It's doing everything it can, ideally, to get a family member with a green card somewhere. And that's kind of like a futures market where you have the people who are the benefiting the most from the Chinese system, hedging their bets to find somewhere they can escape to. And that doesn't suggest a great deal of confidence in the future. Will something happen tomorrow? No. But who knows, 50 years from now. And there is something, I mentioned elsewhere that the Chinese Communist Party, when you listen to the leaders talk, they sound almost like old South African, like the Afrikaners in the apartheid era, who swore that the black Africans liked to be oppressed, that they understood force, that they respected force, and that that was the only way to govern South Africa. And the Chinese Communist Party guys sound just like that, saying that the Chinese have to be repressive, you have to control them, you can't handle democracy. They can't handle freedom, and thus we have to have this oppressive communist system. And it's just like the old South Africa. And it, in both cases, I think they're wrong. And in China's case, all you have to do is look across the Taiwan Strait to Taiwan, where you have Taiwanese doing, who are Chinese, ultimately doing very well with consensual government, democracy, and individual freedom, all these things which the Communist Party says China cannot, Chinese can't handle. So I think that, who knows, years from now, this, we may just find that China looks very different than it does today.
Interesting. All right. Is there anything that you would like to share with us that I haven't been smart enough to ask you in particular today, things that you've recently written? So make us tell us where we find your latest work.
Well, you can find all the really good stuff. And, no, it's all good. But the, if Asia, I write regularly for Asia Times. So if you type my name, Nusham, Asia Times, you'll get all the latest stuff. Okay. And there's a couple that are pretty good. I wrote them, so of course I think so. But then the most recent one just yesterday suggesting that the U.S. military leadership and also the civilian leadership too, but that part got cut out of the article, have underestimated Chinese military capabilities. And I think that might be of interest. If you type my name into Nusham Asia Times, it tends to bring up some of the things I've written. But I was trying to write. The advice I was given once was write like I'm writing for my mother, and be constructive. So I try to make it understandable and ideally interesting, and also have some ideas about how to fix things.
All right. Would you mind if you would you mind coming back in a week and talking specifically about that?
Sure. I've got some opinions.
It's been a while, and we had some ground to cover today. And to me, very interesting. Not only our discussion about what it is to be an intelligence person in a democracy, and how you ought to behave in terms of things going on currently in Washington D.C. But has anything changed relative to China, and then up to the Korean Peninsula, and if kinetics broke out, how that fight would happen, and who's who in the zoo there? But I'd love to talk about if we're underestimating China, how we're doing it, and what is the downside? And so I will be in touch, and we'll do this again in a week.
Sure, now I'll get the timing right.
It was my equally is my fault. I assumed you were correct failed to supervise. Next time it will be different. Thank you very much.
Watch out. Mm-hmm.
That is Grant Nusham here on a Wednesday. Not too much good news on the planet. What the hell, man? What the hell? We're going to take a quick break. The president is actually John Kelly speaking. At the Coast Guard commencement. John Kelly in a dark suit and a black tie. So the president is standing by to speak. So we'll see. We'll take a break, and we'll see if he makes any comments worthy, and so we'll see if we can catch the beginning of his speech relative to it's at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. So John Kelly speaking now. I think the president would speak after him. So we will take a quick break. My thanks to Grant Nusham, former retired Marine Corps colonel. And so Grant joins us today, and with thoughts on China and North Korea. Not a whole lot about Japan today. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't touch that dial, whatever you do.